Join us as we welcome Brian McGowan, President and CEO of Centennial Yards, for an exclusive deep dive into one of the most ambitious real estate developments in the country. Discover how this $6 billion, 50-acre project is set to transform the urban landscape, connect isolated neighborhoods, and bring a new vibrancy to the city. Learn about Brian's remarkable career journey, his insights on public transit, and the future plans for Centennial Yards. Tune in for a conversation packed with visionary ideas and exciting developments on this episode of The Marketing Madman.
They say marketing is a madman's game. So now we turn it over to the Marketing Madman with Nick Constantino and Trip Joel.
Happy Saturday and welcome to the Marketing Madman. Nick Constantino here, and we got a big show today. And the reason I say big is not necessarily because of how awesome I am. It's because of the big property in which we're talking about. So today we are talking about Centennial Yards, which is one of the largest, and at some point in this show we'll get the real dollar amount, one of the largest real estate developments, commercial real estate developments that's happening in this country. It's in the middle of downtown Atlanta, and the president and CEO of that company is Brian McGowan, and he is here with me today. Brian, how you doing, bud?
I'm good, Nick. How are you?
So we will get the real number because you say $5 billion. Ha, I know what that means. So before we get to Centennial Yards, and I can't state how big of a deal this is. As somebody who's been involved in the sports world with World Cup coming and Super Bowl, I can't state how important this is. It feels like it's been the missing gap in one of the greatest cities in, like, we're having our Detroit in the car boom moment. Mm-hmm. This city is the epicenter of everything. I've been lucky enough to be around it. But it will not do justice to talk about this until we talk about your history and what got you into the point where you're the guy they picked to take on this monumental task because...
No pressure.
Like we're going to talk about behind the scenes. Oh, my goodness. So let's start. You were appointed by Barack Obama to be U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce.
Yes.
Talk about that. Talk about what got you there, what it was like to get that call, and what the day-to-day actually entailed.
Yeah, I mean, I'll even step back to the job before that, which was I worked for Arnold Schwarzenegger for 3 years. So I was Deputy Secretary of Commerce for the state of California.
Which most people should know, probably don't, that California by itself is like the seventh or eighth biggest economy in the world. Fifth biggest economy in the world. Just California by itself.
Yeah. It's definitely a country in and of itself. But so prior to that, I was working for cities and counties in Southern California. So I went to college in Southern, I grew up in New York, New Jersey, went to college in Southern California. First job out of college, I worked for the city of Palm Springs, California.
Okay.
Sonny Bono, for the young people on the phone, listening to the show, don't know who Sonny Bono is, but he was a actor, comedian, singer. He was our former mayor and our congressman when I worked for the city of Palm Springs, and then I worked for a couple of other cities and counties, and then I got a call to go into the Schwarzenegger administration. So. Which, of course, you say yes. You can't say no
for
to
so many reasons.
To Arnold.
To say many, so many reasons.
Yeah, the governor. So I went there, did that for 3 years. Amazing job. Got to travel around the world with him and sell California, which is an amazing state. And my job was economic development, economic growth. And then Barack Obama got elected. And I was really impressed with him and what he was doing and saying. And I knew at some point I'd want to work in the federal government, and I felt like that was the moment. So I started calling everybody I knew. Remember, I was working for a Republican governor, and Barack is a Democrat. So I was calling everybody I knew to figure out, did I know somebody that knew somebody that knew somebody? I'm on LinkedIn. I'm trying to figure out the relationships. I'm firing my resume out because these jobs are hard to get as a presidential appointee.
Sure.
And you typically have to have volunteered on the campaign or donated a lot of money. And so I fired out a bunch of resumes, kind of gave up, and then suddenly I got a call. It was a message. It was, I'm so-and-so from the White House liaison office, and we'd like you to fly to Washington, D.C. next week to meet with the Secretary of Commerce. You
know? Cool.
So I listened to it, and I play it for my wife. I go, that's not like any of my friends screwing with me here. Sounds legit, right?
Yeah.
So she's like, yeah, I think that's legit. Yeah. So I called, and I flew to Washington, D.C., and long story short, I got the job. And there were like two parts of the job. So I was running the U.S. Economic Development Administration, which is
mega behemoth.
Won't get into all that, but it's, you know, economic growth and competitiveness across the United States. And then the BP oil spill happened.
Yep.
And so the Secretary of Commerce asked me if I'd be interested in, literally called me into his office. There was a National Incident Command set up to respond to the BP oil spill. Secretary of Commerce says, They're looking for someone to run the economic solutions team within the National Incident
Did
Command.
Did you throw air quotes on that? economic solutions team? Yeah, yeah. You're the fall guy. Hey, when,
that's like, I was like, what is this? Like, let's. I literally asked him, I said, so what, but you know, I'm interested, but tell me about the job. And he goes like, I don't know what the job is, but I need to know like right now, do you want to do it or not?
So that's about right.
I was like, yeah, sure. You know, and then a week later, I'm sitting in the Situation Room with all these people you see on TV, and I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to help communities along the Gulf kind of mitigate the impacts of the oil spills. It was an amazing experience.
Yeah, so I have so many questions, but I'm going to start with one from each of these things because I think it's, again, set up why you're in the job you are now. So for the first one, I've been to Palm Springs. It is an odd place. It's 123 degrees. It really will get that hot.
Oh, yeah.
Hotter. Coachella didn't exist back in that time, so people didn't have the attention to Joshua Tree and some of those mm-hmm. things in the area. I remember there was one kind of crappy casino like as you're coming in off the highway. But that being said, it was a huge tourism. There was a lot of tourism in Palm Springs, right?
So how much was tourism
a part of what you were doing in Palm Springs? And then for Schwarzenegger, were you involved? Because you're talking about economic development. Tourism is a huge part of that.
Well, in Palm Springs, I wasn't involved in tourism at all. My job was to get the city less dependent on tourism by attracting industries and other types of companies there. Now, when I was in the Schwarzenegger administration, I oversaw a large portfolio which included the tourism campaign called Visit California. Yep. So that was part of the portfolio that I was overseeing, so which is a huge, huge program, marketing California. So, tourism creates jobs, economic growth, and impact, and we know this in Atlanta. That's why we're such a sports city and we attract all these big events. So, yes, it's a really strong economic development tool.
Okay. So, next question. This is going to be a harder one. The next question is, how happy are you when you got the call from the federal government to be involved that Facebook didn't exist when you were a child and none of the things that you did and mistakes you made were on record?
So happy. You know, I have to tell a funny little story.
I always ask every politician, like, oh, thank God there was no social media when I was young. And I'm I hear you.
I have five sons, three off the payroll, so they're in their 20s.
Congrats.
For the moment.
Right.
I tell them all the time, you got to be very careful what you're posting. I tell young people all the time, be careful what you're posting. So I was happy, but there was this one incident came up. So I had top secret clearance to get into the administration. Okay. So there was no problem there. FBI literally shows up at your house.
Yeah.
They interview your neighbors. You know, they ask your friends for three people that know you as well. So they try to go really deep to find things. And thank God there was nothing to find.
Yeah.
Let's be clear, where's the camera? Yeah. Nothing to find. And so I ended up in the administration. But when I worked on the BP oil spill work, because there was a meeting in the Situation Room every Friday, I had to have a higher level of clearance. So I wasn't concerned. I fill out the forms and 2 weeks later, I get a call saying, you know, I think it was the National Security Agency, some agents from the National Security Agency want to come and talk to you. You get kind of a cold sweat. You're like, huh?
Yeah.
Like, okay.
Is it about something specific?
Yeah. So so this is funny. So I'm nervous. I'm like, what? Did I miss something? Or like, you know, two agents come in, literally in black suits, no smiles, just like out of a movie. And they said, so we looked into your background. We found an issue. I'm like, oh, okay.
You found it. I didn't know about it.
This is going to be fascinating. This is what it was. She goes, so we found an unpaid ticket for when you were a junior in high school.
Whoa.
I was like, I had a ticket when I was a junior in high school. Like, I didn't even remember.
They still keep records of that?
It was crazy.
Wow.
So anyway, she's like,
did they make you pay it?
Yeah. She goes,
with interest or without interest?
You have to clear that up. Thank God, no interest. Yeah. But they had to go like back in, you know, I'm older than you. They had to go to the warehouse and look through boxes and shift through files.
Oh,
it wasn't like they could Google it or search it on a search, you know, engine.
Yeah.
It was, they had to actually go find the original ticket, and I ended up having to pay it before I could actually be approved.
12
for
bucks?
It was something.
What are we talking about?
When they told me, I started laughing. I'm like, oh my God, a speeding ticket?
Oh,
that's what this is about. I was like, that's easy. We can fix that.
So that was such a better story. So the last question is more about BP. So this was a huge point in this country where a lot of the tides started turning on oil, and there was so much involved here.
Yeah.
What were the takeaways that you got from that about how to interact with the public and how to, because I think one of the problems now is the easiest answer is just kind of deny and just blow it off like it didn't happen. What did you learn from having to tackle that head on and deal with all the people whose lives were affected? What did you learn from that damage control?
You know, I think the big takeaway for me was when I was formulating the plan of what we were going to do to mitigate the economic impacts. You know, you're sitting roomfuls of Harvard economists, right, and MBAs, smart people, and they're all talking about analysis. Well, you know, we need some data. And I'm like, well, I'd like to deploy 21 teams across the Gulf from Bay County, Florida to Galveston, Texas, and get on the ground and listen to people and talk to people. And there was one economist, his name is Jared Bernstein. He's still, I think he's in the White House now. And he said, well, can't we just deploy one or two teams and then extrapolate?
You know, because Galveston, Texas is the same.
Right. I was like, I literally said this, like, oh, you understand the accents from one county to the next in one state, Louisiana, are different. The industries are different. They're completely different things. Besides the fact that a lot of this is they just want to know people care. Like us getting on the ground and sitting in the room, people looking them in the eyes and asking them, how is this affecting you, was meaningful, like very, very meaningful. And so that was the big takeaway, was that these are all great people. They're hardworking. It was oil industry, fisheries, tourism. And they just wanted to feel like Washington, D.C. cared about their plight and what they were dealing with. And fortunately, because at that moment I was reporting directly to the president, I had the authority to kind of reach into any federal agency and pull resources to apply to a particular situation. So it was good.
I think it's an age-old story. It's in marketing. It's in business. Data only tells half the story. And when you become over-reliant on data, you cannot...
that's what exactly right.
That people are desperate for an emotional connection.
Yeah.
And the emotional connection is not a guy saying, hey, yay or nay, or on a scale of 1 to 10, it is a personal connection. And I think, you know, if I'm speaking for you, I have to imagine that reinforcing how important the relationship is and how emotional connection, no one's going to come to your place because you're looking at them as a number. They're going to come to your place because it made them feel happy, and you can't quantify that with some data set.
And also, you know, shaking someone's hand and looking them in the eyes, this is, you know, work from home. I'm old school.
Me too.
Our organization, everybody's back in the office full time. I think you really lose something by just being on a Teams or Zoom call without actually looking in someone's eyes and reading their body language and shaking their hand, and the serendipitous interactions you have between those meetings.
I agree completely.
You miss out on all
that. And I think for us, the big thing was it is hard to hold someone accountable over a Zoom. It's hard to hold someone accountable who's not wearing pants.
Agreed.
Because like they haven't decided that day to put them on. Right? They're just going to take the button down because it's like...
Point.
So, all right. So now that we talked about not wearing pants, we'll go back to our first commercial break. You've been listening to The Marketing Madman on Extra 106.3, and we'll be right back.
Now back to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3 FM.
Welcome back to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3, and we'd like to assure you that everyone here is wearing pants. So now that we've covered, now that our first segment went long because you had so much stuff to talk about and we just went on tangents as we usually do here, let's get us caught to speed of Atlanta. Let's talk about the Beltline. Let's talk about Invest Atlanta. Let's talk about the Metro Chamber. And I don't want to belittle any of those things because every one of them is hugely important, but I want to get to Centennial Yard. So let's bring us up to speed on everything you've done in Atlanta that has set you up to this point.
Yeah. So I came to Atlanta, I left the Obama administration, and I was the CEO of the Atlanta Development Authority, which is now...
Did you take a small breath when you left government?
Not a day. Literally from a Friday to a Monday. Okay. I think it was something like that. So there wasn't time. Kasim Reed was mayor. He was looking for somebody to run his development authority. This is 2011. We're like still in the throes of recession, and we're emerging, but... You know, the phones weren't ringing. So I ended up CEO of the Atlanta Development Authority, which I renamed and called Invest Atlanta and kind of repositioned it. Job of that entity was, besides affordable housing and other things, small business support, is to attract investment to the city, right?
Yeah.
2011, the phones weren't ringing. You know, I mean, companies weren't making big decisions to move, and so we really, it was a stressful time. The entity I inherited was also insolvent, which I didn't really fully understand until 2 weeks after I started the job and got to see the books.
It would have been nice if you got to vet that out in advance, like the Secret Service did to you.
It might have changed my decision, but thank God it got me to Atlanta, which I was really, really happy, but my family's really happy about that. So we fixed it and we rebranded it and we moved it and we, you know, had to fire some people and hire good people, and that entity is now up and running and doing very well.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that when you think of the name, first of all, how important a name is, right? Invest Atlanta is so simple.
Well, it was also the Atlanta Development Authority sounds scary, right?
Too much.
And the other thing was everyone called it the ADA. So the ADA was Americans with Disability Act, American Dental Association, Assistant District Attorney. There were too many other ADAs that came to mind. But it was really the word authority. You know, it's like it just sounded like a scary government thing.
Yeah, so, for sure. Yeah. All right. So that is an entity that continues on today. And obviously you've done a great job because the amount of investment, and I get firsthand to see it, a lot of it's sports wise, a lot of it's just the businesses that are coming in. As one of the last locally owned media companies, part of the allure to people working with us is, hey, we want to let people know we're in Atlanta. We want to let people know we're building these things down the road because there is a pride around this city that 100%. It has come about. And, you know, we're at the cultural hub of so much that's here. You know, New Yorkers have always had it. DC, that bell, it is a different world to be on K Street. And everyone walks around with their badge on, even though they're like a third level intern for a Tuesday. They wear that badge out to happy hour like it's
very,
a point of pride.
Very true.
Those points DC of pride, thing. LA, San Diego, these cities have it. Atlanta and the San, they didn't, but it has come, it is a shot.
It's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable what's happened. So you did a great job there. So what was next on the ride?
Then I went to the Metro Atlanta Chamber. Okay. So I was the executive vice president, chief operating officer there.
Okay.
They had a new CEO. She didn't have a lot of community economic development experience. So they hired me to kind of run the economic development team at the chamber, which was really fun because it was my first really non-government job. It's a nonprofit, basically. So, so I did that for 3 years, which was fantastic and kind of showed me a different view of the world, but also it was regional. So Invest Atlanta is just the city of Atlanta, and the Metro Atlanta Chamber represents the 29-county region, the Atlanta region. So I got to learn about Gwinnett County and Cherokee County and all the other places that I hadn't really been paying a lot
of
attention to.
And like you said, things change pretty quickly, right? To go from DeKalb County to Forsyth County to
Cherokee they're very
County,
different.
They're very, very different. And I would say, you know, probably even more so here than most places because they're growing so fast and they grow their own unique character.
They do.
So leaving Atlanta, and I tell people all the time, like, look, if you think you're going to advertise to Atlanta and the part that's going to resonate with someone in Milton, like these are different parts of the world to some
very,
extent.
Very different cultures, different vernacular, different the upbringings for, of people within this region of 20. It's 6 million people. So it's the 10th largest economy in America. So it's pretty significant.
Yeah. So let's get to the Beltline.
Yes.
And I want to because this is the perfect parallel to what's going on at Centennial. So talk about when you started there. Talk about when you were there initially. Did you think it would have the impact that it does today?
So I'll start there. No. I wish I did. But so the Beltline is actually a subsidiary of Invest Atlanta. So,
okay.
So when I was the CEO of the Atlanta Development Authority / Invest Atlanta, the Beltline was kind of a part of it. And when I first started, I remember it was much smaller. It was like the East Side Trail hadn't even been, it was just starting construction when I got here in 2011. It was finally pouring concrete. And they were telling me about it and I didn't understand it. They're like, the Beltline, I thought it was some highway transportation project.
Yeah.
And then they brought me out there and they showed it to me. And actually we owned Ponce City Market at the time. And 3 weeks after I started, we sold it to Jamestown. So I was I had to sign,
Old Sears factory, right?
Yeah,
Sears factory.
That's right. Yeah, warehouse. And I didn't get it. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I was like, so we're going to pour this concrete path and that's somehow going to, transform and change things. I wish I could say, I'm the visionary.
Yeah.
I saw it.
But yeah.
I didn't.
I didn't know how many people were into running roller skates. I couldn't fathom how many people would be roller skating on a road.
But then, we start paving and then developers start buying property along that East Side Trail and they're making big bets and big investments. And suddenly you're seeing, oh my goodness, the catalytic effect of that Beltline, I don't think anybody fully anticipated or realized until it started happening.
You know, one of the things after being, especially most of my adult college life was in D.C. And if you start on, I lived on 12th and Mass, and you go up 12th Street or you go up U Street or you go up any of the streets you start walking up, it's just nonstop activity. One of the things Atlanta was missing that I think the Beltline brought to it is it connected these pockets that allowed you to feel like you're out for the day.
Yeah,
like you can start here and then start at Ponce City Market, and then you walk down the Beltline and you end up at Krog Street. And it, it allowed a congruence that the city is not set up for. So I think that is one of the reasons it succeeded.
Agreed.
But also it was a full day long activity, right? You could start and you're just out for the day. And you're riding your bike and you can just drop it. And you can just scooter across here and you can just drop it. It just meant for fun and exercise and all these things that the city was lacking because of how it's set up.
Yeah, I mean, it became and is now a gathering place, right? So, you know, most cities, and, you know, we'll talk about our downtown, have places where people just gather. People want to get dressed up and go out and see their neighbors and be seen and whatnot. And Atlanta didn't
especially
have
these
that.
Young whippersnappers that are coming over here, these good looking kids, and they're going out, want to be in the sun.
They want to date, they want to look for, you know,
God bless it.
Yeah, girlfriends, boyfriends, whatever. So, you know, that probably used to be Peachtree. People go out and walk down the main street and get all dressed up in their kids and walk their dogs. And we didn't have that. So the Beltline became that, became our beachfront property, if you will.
Love
like
it.
That became the place where people gathered.
Yeah. Love it. And you know, one of the things I think is really funny, and it's part of this job. I live in the city. I've been a city kid. I was born in Queens. But the suburban life is so different that I probably tell you there are so many people that live in the suburbs that have still never even been to the Beltline that still have such a bad perception of what it is.
The
things that I hear from people, I'm like, so let me get this straight. You've never read a crime statistic in your life if you think this is the problem.
Yes, seriously.
Right? Like, so I find it fascinating.
True.
But at the same time, you could only be an evangelist for so far, right?
Yeah.
Some point, it's just like, look, if you don't get it, you're not going to get it.
You're never going to get it.
You're never going to get it. And you want to bring people in. And I think that brings up a good segue. So let's talk about Centennial Yard. So, I got a whole bunch of stats in front of me. They probably don't even do justice to how big this is. Talk about what you intend for this to be for Atlanta, what gaps it fills, and how important this is going to be for the next decades of growth in this city.
Yes. Wow. So Centennial Yards, I'll skip to the end. So the end is, it's 50 acres. It'll be probably a $6 billion project. We say it's a $5 billion project.
I got it out of him.
But
inflation. I got it out of him. Just blame inflation. Just blame inflation.
It'll probably be six by the time we're done. You know, you're talking mixed use, probably 2,000 hotel rooms, 3,000 apartments. There'll be office space eventually. But this is, you know, we're going to build new streets. We're connecting the downtown. So it's a massive undertaking, seven, 8 million square feet. So it's just enormous. So it's been referred to as the 50-acre hole in the heart of the city, but I would say it's the 50-acre hole in the heart of the entire region, because Centennial Yards, as some people know, the Gulch, was rail yards, and then the rail yards went away, and then it became parking lots. And, you know, the major feature of our downtown is a gigantic parking lot. Is planes are flying over for Super Bowl and events, and you're looking next door, and it's just a big, giant parking lot. So it's also, unfortunately, it's probably the primary perception people have when they come to the city. So I came to the city for the first time in 2002. I was living in Southern California. I came here for a conference. So I go from the airport to one of the hotels, the Westin, I think.
Yeah.
Then I walk to the convention center, and I walk back to the hotel at night. And I left with a very negative perception of Atlanta. Because I didn't go to Midtown. I didn't go to Buckhead, admittedly. But to me, I was like, oh, this looks like a city that doesn't care about itself, you know?
Yeah, and to be clear, that's the center of the city, right? It looks like Queens.
It's
like
the,
Queens
is
weird holes and like the factory that's there, because Manhattan was the hub and these were the suburbs.
Yeah.
That's the centerpiece. So it's the centerpiece. It's even more
it's where people come, and, you know, 18 million people, 17 million people a year come downtown alone, and over 50 million people... visitors a year come to this region, and they, you know, most people end up downtown for a game or a concert or something like that, and that's their impression, right? So, so the fact that we're investing in this project is going to really change people's perceptions of downtown, but it's also going to change downtown, not just perceptions of downtown, because the way you fix a downtown that's in the state that our downtown is, you get more people living downtown.
For sure.
Right? More people living downtown is more people walking their dogs, sitting at coffee shops.
More money in the tax base that allows you to upgrade.
Peeking through the curtains, you know, calling the police when there's an issue. That's how you make a downtown better, safer, more accommodating to visitors. So this is going to fundamentally change the region. It's going to fundamentally change how people see Atlanta.
Yeah, I think
it's that significant.
The words that come to mind, because again, look, most New Yorkers just talk about New York, and I do it to some extent, but energy and vibrance. There's an energy, and there's, you walk in New York City, and you're like, you kind of just, whoa.
You do.
And you kind of just get,
you
like,
feel the buzz.
You know, there's a lot of cities. Yeah. LA
I'm
is a
from
lot
the
like
Bronx,
that.
So.
but that is what is lacking. It does not have that. This is cool. This is going to be a day. And it, you know what?
Yeah.
Arthur has invested a lot of money. Tony Ressler has invested a lot of money to fill in pieces.
100%.
But it's the connecting piece that is lacking. And I believe that's what this is going to be.
Yes. Yeah. So there's neighborhoods. There's Fairleigh Poplar. There's downtown. There's Castleberry Hill. All of these things are disconnected because there's a big hole right in the middle of it. You know, and we had Andy Young in our office probably about a year ago. And he was staring out the window, and it looked like he was about to say something. And, you know, so you always get he's about to say something. Get close. And he puts his hand on his heart and he goes, this has been the hole in my heart since I ran for mayor.
Wow.
You know, so we found a 1982 article. It was in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that outlined 12 attempts to develop the Gulch. That was up till 1982. And then there were multiple attempts after 1982 to develop this. So there was long time recognition that this was a problem, especially after the rail yards closed up and went away. This is probably 60s. And then there was a train station there that was torn down, and then it became parking lot.
Yeah.
So I think for a long time people knew that this was a problem. But it would require somebody with money, fortitude, because the site is extremely difficult to understand politics.
Yeah. Yep.
And fortunately we had this unique confluence of a guy named Tony Ressler buys the Atlanta Hawks. He looks across the street, sees the big hole in the ground. His vision for that was LA Live. He goes, he told Steve Koonin. So really Steve Koonin, Tony Ressler, the Atlanta Hawks deserve all the credit for this. They were the ones that saw the opportunity. Tony has a brother named Richard Ressler, who's the founder of CIM Group. Centennial Yards Company is a subsidiary of CIM Group. And that's how it got started. Yeah. These two brothers saw this great opportunity, and they raised capital and started this huge, massive investment in our
downtown. And I think Ressler was new to all this, but Steve Koonin has been a fixture in this town for a long time, and he is as proud of an Atlantan as there is. And I'm lucky enough that I've gotten to spend some time with him. First of all, you know, as long as you go up and say something that's meaningful, he'll talk to you. He's a talker.
He's
knows,
very approachable.
He knows where his bread is buttered, and his ability to relate to the people is what his. But then you had Tony come in, and sometimes you need the external person, because sometimes if you've been in the city for so long, it'll never happen.
Yeah.
It can't change.
Yeah,
but then you have the external guy come in, so it's the confluence of the two of them, and I think it's a great thing.
I think that's right. Yeah, I think it took two people from the outside to kind of say, this can happen. You know, we can solve all these big, hairy problems that are on the site. We can fix that. So that's, you know, what happened.
Yeah, so I'm going to throw you off with a question here, because I think it's incredibly important. So you just got rid of a lot of parking. Okay, so one of the problems with this city, if you ask me, is people are too reliant on driving, right? I'm a New York City kid. You take the train everywhere. D.C., you take the train everywhere. Mm-hmm. There's the entertainment hubs. The city's made on it. So part of this, I have to imagine, is also changing the perception of MARTA to get more people to take transit and be involved.
Yeah, that's a really
and that's
good
what a
point.
Vibrant city needs. It needs, because one, it's an equalizer, right? Because when you're on a train with the person who works an hourly job and is cleaning, and everybody's on the train together, that's the beauty of New York City. You have someone worth $250 million that's sitting on a train with somebody who makes $5 an hour. And I know it
Washington,
sounds
D.C.,
stupid. I know it sounds like it's off, but that is one of the things that makes cities great, is that everybody feels like they can succeed. What are the plans? How do you get people to be transit? All these parking lots disappear now. There's so much parking down there. That's why everyone tailgated and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Is that part of the plan? Is that something that you hope changes that starts driving people down there?
Yeah. So the answer is yes. Now we're going to build parking because we're adding a lot of square footage. So people, if you have an apartment, you typically want a parking space. Or if you go down to eat at a restaurant, you want to be able to park your car. So we're going to add parking. But we're purposely under parking it. So we're not going to maximize parking. We could build a lot more parking. I think a lot of people have a misperception that developers love building parking. They don't.
Yeah.
Parking spaces are very expensive to build parking structures. But because we're surrounded by four MARTA stations, there's four MARTA stations around Centennial Yards, we can under park it. You know, so like just as an example, my wife and I were downtown for the Janet Jackson concert at State Farm Arena when across the street was Taylor Swift. So there's probably 110,000 people in downtown Atlanta that night, right? So I told my wife, I go, look, you know, you should pack a lunch because it's going to probably take a minute to get out of there.
Yeah.
It didn't because the Swifties took MARTA.
Yeah.
You know, so it, MARTA works when people take it. And, you know, for United games and for Falcons games, it's packed. And and if everybody drove a car downtown for a Falcons game or a Taylor Swift concert, downtown wouldn't work, right? So our intent is to purposely underpark it.
Yeah.
And we know that will drive people to take MARTA. However, we all know anybody who's taken MARTA, the service needs to be upgraded.
Right.
And so there's lots of talk about renovating the Five Points MARTA station, which... Right. There's discussions, there's money, they're trying to figure out how to do that. But the overall system has to be improved. And this is nothing new to people at MARTA or the city. They understand this. But there's, you know, and it's not just MARTA. MARTA should be expanded. But the bus feeder systems into it, it's a bigger thing. But, you know, as an economist, I tell people all the time, if you can't move people, goods, and information, you cannot grow your economy, right? We are a region that prides ourselves on economic growth. So the Metro Atlanta Chamber and Invest Atlanta, all the entities I work for, they're amazing at selling Atlanta around the world and getting companies to move here. But there's a limit to that. You could probably quantify it.
Yeah.
You know that we're going to hit a wall if we don't add transit.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where
a lot of cities are going through that. Though Austin, Texas is going
through
it. Nashville is going through it. You're so reliant on old infrastructure that if you don't invest, and the reason I ask is because I think what people fail to understand is like when you make a massive change like this, the outward reaches of it, right? So all of a sudden now more people are taking the train. There's more investment going to the train, which means now all these train stations have their own little micro villages that build on them, and then everybody's connected, and that interconnectivity is what I miss about DC and New York. It was easy to get anywhere. Anytime by any way. It is one of the things that, and it's just, you need that for this city to go to 10, 12 million people where you want to be. It is important. And it's really hard because politicians tend to be very short-sighted on their terms only.
It's true.
They're not forward-thinking.
Transit's a long-term investment.
It's a long,
and it's expensive.
And that's why I asked, what is the future of this product? What does this product look like? Tell people what they can look forward to in a couple of years, why to come check you out, but what the scale of this project is going to be.
So the 50 acres, we are full steam ahead now. So we started with an adaptive reuse building. It was an old Norfolk Southern building.
Yep.
So we converted it. It was offices. We converted to 162 apartments. There's a brewery at the base of that called Wild Leap, which if you're a United fan, you've probably been there.
Yep.
There was a bridge connecting Castleberry to South Downtown called the Nelson Street Bridge. The city condemned it in 2017. I think it was literally unsafe to walk on. We committed to tearing it down and rebuilding it. So now it's rebuilt and open as a pedestrian bridge. There's art along that bridge too. Very popular with like roller skaters and TikTokers. Love videoing out there.
Yeah, I love the roller skaters.
It's really nice.
Not even roller bladers. They're too cool for that. They're
roller
skates.
Roller skating is old school.
Let's make sure we're clear.
Old school.
Yeah,
Usher. You know, that's Usher's thing. So the second of those two buildings is a 90,000 square foot building, which we are going to convert to a boutique hotel.
Yeah.
That work will start first quarter next year. We just announced another boutique hotel on the Castleberry Hillside of that building. And then we have two buildings. If anybody's been downtown recently, you'll see a whole bunch of construction cranes in what was the Gulch.
Yeah.
So we have two buildings under construction. We just topped out on one. It's called the Mitchell. It's an apartment complex, 300 apartments, three restaurants at the base of it. Literally across the street from the Mercedes-Benz logo on the stadium.
Cool.
And then right across the street from that is a hotel that we're building, a 300-room hotel. Really going to be the sexiest, coolest hotel in Atlanta when it opens because it's so close and it's really a beautiful building. The architect is TVS. They did a beautiful job. That will top out on December 18th. Both of those buildings and the five restaurants between them will be open this time next year.
Oh, wow.
So you can imagine that alone, five new restaurants, because, you know, right now you go downtown, there's not a whole lot of choices. That's going to fundamentally change how people experience downtown, that alone. And then we just made the announcement on the new entertainment district.
Yeah.
Which is huge.
Well, you know, one of the things that is blatantly clear is in 2 or 3 years, you're not going to recognize downtown.
No, you won't.
But the good thing is that there is something about, like, look, New York City, there's energy, but it feels old. it's yeah, dirty, yeah. And this just feels like you're going to go into a place that is going to have some of the best parts of Asia and Abu Dhabi and in these big cities because you're building from scratch. And the investment, $6 billion 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it would have been unheard of that anyone's going to spend that much money on one project. That's the reality. And it's damn good for Atlanta. It is damn good for the people that are going to embrace it. And what I encourage people, don't wait. Go down, dream about what it's going to look like have to be a part of this. And don't just go to a game, stay and play, go early, come to our tailgate. I can get a notification, stop by.
Great location.
There's so much to it. So quick in the last minute of this segment, talk about how impactful this is going to be for all these big sporting events coming in. Like you said, you had to sign a letter for the Super Bowl to bring them in. They want this infrastructure. They want this development.
Yeah, because again, there's not enough to do downtown when people come downtown. So between the two buildings we have under construction, and then we just broke ground on four new buildings in the entertainment district, which is 8 acres, 500,000 square feet of buildings. One of those concepts is COSM, which I won't get into, but it's a really cool new concept. First one opened at SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles. Yep. Second one's in Dallas. Third one will be Atlanta. We're going to build a 5,000-seat live music venue, hotel, and then a multi-tenant food and beverage building with a fan zone in between those buildings that can hold 5,000 people. So there'll be digital signage and billboards up, and it'll be a super exciting place for people to gather. We want that done by World Cup, which is mid-26. So that's our first deadline.
We got to have that done by
World Cup. Now, the buildings will be core and shell. They won't be complete interiors, but the fan zone will be there. We just don't want it to be a big construction site.
Yeah, for sure.
And it won't be. It'll look good, and it'll be painted and lit and the digital signage will be up, so it'll be an exciting place. All of that is, and Dan Corso, who runs the sports council, you and I talked about this, is really important to if we're attracting other events. So whether it's World Cup or Super Bowl or Final Four or College Football Championship game, this is going to help our region attract more of those types of events to downtown.
Yeah.
Also conventions. We didn't talk about the George Will Congress Center across the street there, which is the fourth busiest in America. Same thing. More stuff to do downtown, more stuff. More places to stay downtown is going to cause more of this economic impact to want to be here.
I think what I'm hearing, there is a difference between sustaining and building to compete and trying to be trailblazing. And it sounds like what we're building, this set is going to be trailblazing for the country. I'm really excited about it. When we get back from the break, we're going to talk a little bit about the future here, but also what the future of these mixed-use projects are, because you see them on every corner. We're in one right now. So you've been listening to The Marketing Madman on Extra 106.3, and we'll be right back.
Now back to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3 FM.
Welcome back to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3. So we're going to finish our conversation because, as usual, we've got to talk about marketing. So Brian, let's talk a little bit about this. Is an unbelievable thing. Anyone that sat through this entire thing is probably already blown away. They probably got more information than they thought they would. However, there's a lot of preconceived notions about downtown. How do you market this? How do you get people excited? Yeah. But how do you change perceptions? And how do you get people to give it a chance? Because it sounds like if they give it a chance, they're going to get down there and they're going to be blown away.
Yeah.
So what does the strategy look like? And all the things you've done, damage control, you've done economic development, all these things that they taught you, all this comes into play here. Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, Talk about what your vision is for how you get this word out and what message you have to people about the property and what it's going to be like.
So I have a colleague who works with us, his name is Ben Reeves, and he said this to me like 2 years ago. He's the best marketing is construction cranes in the air. so we really focused initially in a very bad real estate market to get buildings under construction. So now keep in mind, we had an apartment building that opened 3 years ago, but it wasn't new. It was an adaptive reuse, existing building. So we really wanted to get, and Tony Ressler wanted to get two construction cranes in the air, those two buildings under construction. And I thought the minute we got those construction cranes up, I wouldn't have to, like, because the big question I get around town is, when are you guys going to get started? Like, I don't see anything.
Is it
real?
They've been talking about the golf being redeveloped for five, six years.
So I got the construction cranes up, and then I still got the questions, you know? And it confused me. I'm like, do you not see the construction cranes? And the answer was people didn't, because I really think the gulch became sort of a blind spot for people. You just didn't look over there. But also, for the first year, you're pouring concrete in the ground. So once the buildings got up to viaduct, which is 40 feet up, remember, everything we're building is on stilts, has to be in the air, 40 feet in the air. Once we started to get above
that. Freaking engineering.
Oh my God, I'm so blown away, amazed by my team that does that, you know, because But by the way, we're self-performing, which means we are the general contractor. So we're building those buildings ourselves, which is really amazing.
So you're the one that's putting the time crunch on yourselves to get things done, which makes it harder. An external person saying, we're not going to pay the bill. Let's get it ready. You're deadlining yourself.
Deadlines are good. That's, I believe, deadlines are good. But when the building started stacking up above Viaduct, that's when people started noticing. People like, oh, I see you're finally getting going, and it's so exciting.
Yeah.
And I remember standing in my office. It was a city council person. Our offices overlooked the site. And he was staring out the window, and he looked like he was tearing up. And I turned to him. I go, you okay? He goes, yeah, it's just a sight I never thought I would see is actual buildings going up in the gulch. You know, so from a marketing perspective, that's like the number one thing. The second,
it makes it real. It's got to be tangible before you can market it. It's got to be something that's tangible and real.
The second thing we did really was when I got there, they had a brand, you know. So it was Centennial Yards, a certain brand, but it was black and yellow.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Pittsburgh Steelers.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Right. And it turns out the guy who was leading that
effort was from
Pittsburgh.
It could be
the
Georgia Tech yellow jacket.
Well, it could be a little
more gold hue.
We got the Falcons across the street and the Hawks, and it just didn't feel. So we created a new branding system that felt more like Atlanta. In fact, Steve Coonan, thankfully, was involved in that process, and he loved it. So it really tells a great story.
Yeah, and that in itself can probably be a whole podcast, right? The colors and the hues and what goes into a brand of something this big is unbelievable. And I think most people would never in their wildest dreams, unless you've seen a brand guide of like a big bank and seen the 60 pages of if you have the wrong color scheme on it, how complicated it is.
Yeah,
I've never had someone actually explain to me who made it or what the purpose is. I've just said, this is what we do. Okay.
Yeah, right.
So,
the brand should tell a story, and you know, there's a history to the site. It's where Atlanta was founded, and our logo actually tells that whole story. So it was a really cool process. But the other thing is things like this podcast and panels. So we wanted to make sure Atlantans knew about Centennial Yards. Yeah. I still get the question. You're like, I'm at a restaurant or I meet somebody and they go, what do you do? And I go, I'm the president of Centennial Yards, and they say, what's that? Now, when I was the CEO of the Beltline, that never happened. Yeah. I'd say the CEO of the Beltline.
Yeah, but you were 15, 20 years ahead.
Right, right. So we want to make sure that Atlantans, and by Atlantans, I mean the region, not just the city, know about the project. They are our best sales tool, right? It's just word of mouth, having people say, there's a really exciting project happening in downtown Atlanta. Yep. You need to know about it. Or we need to be there. That's great. Our next phase is, and we're doing other things around that, like I said, panels and meetings around town and podcasts, and we actually have QR codes on the sidewalks around the site, so you can do a self-guided tour. You can come downtown and you scan the QR code and hold your phone up, and it'll show you what the future condition will look like.
So you can augmented reality.
So you can hold it up and see the building in that place. So it's a really, and we encourage people to do that. Encourage people to follow us on social media. You know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Am I missing anything else? Those are the ones.
Are we TikToking?
We need to be TikToking. You know, that's the cool thing for the moment.
For the moment.
Yeah, right. And then the next real phase is like there are these big projects like Hudson Yards and others in New York that everyone's heard of. And we want to make sure now that we're kind of pushing the story more nationally and internationally over the next year or two.
Yeah.
And that will happen. You know, you announce COSM.
Yeah.
We're going to announce a new well-known partner who's going to run the live theater. Soon, we have celebrity investors in the project, including Usher and others who want to
Life
do more and talk more about the project through their social media following and things like that. So we're really in the ramp up stage now. You know, like, things are starting to really take off. Like, I've been in the shop about 3 years now. I tell people all the time, if you start a new job, you know, as president, CEO, or of anything, it really takes 3 years to get your legs under where you really feel like you know what you're doing. And we're there now. Like, people, there's awareness, there's construction, there's money, and we're really moving as fast as we possibly can.
Yeah. Buzz, excitement. I think one of the funniest things is when I first moved here, I knew nothing about Atlanta. Right? I knew that, like, Outkast was from here. Like, that was the end of it. Like, I got here and I grew more Southern as the years went. You know, you get your Big Green Egg. Like, you just all of a sudden
you say,
start.
Y'all.
So, but it took me but 3 weeks to realize I was telling everybody, oh my God, you have no idea how Atlanta is. All my friends in New York. And I go, you know what? I don't want any of you here. Let me just stop telling people about the city. So how do you walk that fine line of, like, look, this is this amazing, mega, mega place, but just come as a tourist. We don't want you here. How do you walk? We want everybody here. I'm joking. Yeah. But that being said, you also don't want the city to completely change what it looked like and forget the charm that brought us here. And it's a hard, it's a fine line to
walk. Well, it's funny you say that because somebody just yesterday, we had a Korean delegation in the office yesterday, and somebody asked me the question, what keeps you up at night? So besides everything, there's a couple of things. But one of them is, how do we make sure that we create a project so that when you're sitting in the middle of Centennial Yards 8 years from now, you're having a cup of coffee and whatever you're seeing, feeling, hearing couldn't be anywhere else but Atlanta. Like it's like, how do we make it unique to Atlanta? You know, so that keeps me up at night because it would be easy to fill it with a Fuddruckers and a Starbucks and all the other things where you could be in anywhere city in America.
Yeah.
But how do you make it so that you know you're in Atlanta and whatever you're looking at and feeling and hearing and seeing and smelling is unique to Atlanta? So that's really the next phase of this, is to make sure that you have this good combination of, you need some of the national stuff as we host these big global events and the convention center, et cetera, but how do we showcase Atlanta as well? So like one of the ideas, you being an Atlantan by choice as I am, is you learn about all the amazing people that come from Atlanta, actors and in particular music. Like I argue, and I'll win this argument, that Georgia is better at music than any other state in America.
Okay.
Like just from, because we have it all. It's not just country or one genre. We have it all.
No. But R.E.M., Allman Brothers, Ray Charles,
it goes on and on.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't know it. So I want to do like a walk of fame in Centennial Yards where people can say like, I didn't know Gladys Knight was from Atlanta. Like I did not know that before I moved here.
Right.
So
you have to be in Atlanta to know a lot of that stuff too.
You do,
but
you shouldn't be.
But everyone should be.
Like, you know, Nashville does a great job at marketing itself as a music city. And I think we could be doing a much better job. I mean, the whole notion of Atlanta influences everything. I believe that it's true.
Yeah.
And I think Centennial Yards could be a showcase for that.
You know,
not just music and art and entertainment, but businesses. Like we envision innovation centers, you know, and the big corporations having presence in Centennial Yards with their sign up on the building, you know, so that I think it could, if we do it right, it could be a real showcase
and
for the entire
region.
And so
much goes into each one of those things. So that's the thing is like, everyone wants to do all these things and you'll probably pick and choose and it'll develop and it will become a living thing, which is what I'm most excited about. So Brian, our time is done. This has been awesome. Just real quick, what are the social handles? How do they find you? What's the best place to look? At Centennial Yards.
At Centennial Yards.
There you go. Yeah. Hit them up on socials, find out. And most importantly, come check it out. You've been listening to the Marketing Madman on Action 106.3. We will catch you next week.